WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. P.W. Singer is one of the foremost thinkers on war, where war is heading, and he has consulted for the U.S. military and for the FBI, and now he has teamed up with August Cole, a former Wall Street Journal reporter who covered the defense industry, and they have written a fictionalized account of where we might be headed into World War III, where war is fought with guns and bombs, of course, but also with computer viruses and technology that's already with us to some degree. This hour, On Point, we look at the future of warfare through fiction, and it's so real, it's kind of scary. You can join us online or on air. How do you imagine another world war? Are conventional weapons a thing of the past? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is P.W. Singer, strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He has consulted for the U.S. military, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the FBI. He is the author of a lot of nonfiction, Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know, and Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. But his new book, written with August Cole, is Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war. Peter, welcome from Washington.
Thank you.
And joining me right here in the studio in Boston is August Cole. He is the co-author of Ghost Fleet and senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council, where he is director of the Art of Future War Project. August, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here.
And you can read an excerpt of this book. I'm going to let you know right now, Ghost Fleet, on our website, onpointradio.org. So let's start with this sort of Jules Verne thing that the two of you have done, imagining a future that is not so very fantastical when you put it in terms of what the next war will look like. August Cole, what it seems as though what you and Peter have set out to do is to create a scenario of extreme technological plausibility, that the things that go on in this war, which seems to be 20 to 30 years in the future, 40 years in the future from now, employs technology that we're already all touching to some degree.
Well, that's right. All the technology in Ghost Fleet is real. It is technology that is either in development or in the process of being put into the field by the military, but also the civilian world. The future of warfare will have technology playing a major role, but at the same time, war remains fundamentally a human endeavor. So in the story, what we've done is really weave that together. There is a lot of the familiar. We have naval battles that you would have seen in World War II alongside new battle domains like cyber and space where we haven't fought. And those are particularly important to think about because we're talking about a great power conflict, which is totally different than what the nation's been focused on for the last 15 years or so.
And Peter Singer, just give us the broad outline of who's against who in this war and how did it come about?
So the book is a techno-thriller that brings together the concept of a great power conflict in the 21st century and what it might look like. And so if you're going to do that, you pull what are the great powers and which are the ones that are at a point of rivalry. And so essentially the players in it is the U.S. and China, which is the emerging great power of the 21st century, and China's junior partner that I joke doesn't yet realize it's the junior Russia. And again, the book is fiction, but it's drawn from real-world trends. So if you're looking in the real world, for example, NATO is on its highest levels of alert since the mid-1980s with Russian land grabs in the Ukraine, whereas in the Pacific, the U.S. and China are in what can only be described as an arms race. China's built more warships, more warplanes than any other nation in 2012, 2013, 2014. You kind of get the picture here. And in turn, we've developed a new military strategy to offset them with a new generation of technology. And so what the book looks at is this period in the years ahead of what if there was a war? And then as August mentioned, it plays it out in all of these different domains. So it doesn't follow a single character, but multiple characters on land, at sea, fighting in the air, and then in these new places of space and cyberspace. And the one thing I would, you know, add to it is, again, it's fiction, but it comes with 400 endnotes to document how every single technology, no matter how crazy science fiction it seems, is real. And it kind of echoes back to you mentioned Jules Verne. You know, he once did that with submarines and then they became real. So we're trying to do the same here.
so much of what you're talking about is already real. A number of the characters wear a sort of they're wearing a technology on their heads that is reminiscent of, or probably a descendant of, the Google Glass concept, and it's everywhere in the book. Everybody has one except older people who don't really think they need it and almost philosophically don't want to touch it. But am I looking at Google Glass, August Cole?
I think you're looking at a technology that's the next iteration of that, which we will see coming down the pike. And what's really useful as a writer in introducing some technology like that is that it lets you explore the generational divides around technology and what that will be like in wartime. You know, future warfare involves elements from traditional conflict, again, a naval battle like the U.S. hasn't seen in 70 years, but also this really high-tech form of warfare with autonomous drones, with directed energy weapons, or what we call lasers in common parlance. You know, this is a way to explore that, because when we think about the kind of efforts that the U.S. would have to make in the face of an adversary like China, it would be an entire whole-of-nation effort. Yet you'd have generational differences and different ways of utilizing and thinking about technology that are obviously more extreme in our book, but are very real problems today, even in the military's own desire to use technology as it did during the Cold War to create an enduring advantage, a lasting advantage against any big adversary out there like China. Well, there is a generational aspect to that, both in terms of development and conception, but also implementation and employment in the field.
So I'm going to give away a little bit of the book, just the beginning, because that would be the first scene in the movie. And so let's say we're not working on spoilers here. But the war basically begins when the Chinese space station, the second or third generation of the space station that's actually there now, and one that is actually planned it's on the drawing boards for China right now. So it gets built, and it's big, and it's used essentially to deploy a weapon that at the very beginning of the book attacks other American objects in space, American military satellites in space. And number one, is that feasible? Is the actual sort of laser that's deployed by the Chinese to start zapping American satellites, is that technology already there today? Could China do this in 15 years?
Space is supposed to be a place of peace. This is the hope, and it's been the longstanding ambition. But as we know from the 20th century and as we enter the 21st century, there is such an important military role that it plays in the way communications, navigation, targeting, surveillance all happen, that it is absolutely certain that in a great power conflict with a nation like China, that even in a skirmish with a country like Russia over the Baltics, that assets in space, meaning communications, satellites, that are both commercial or government, will be targeted. So there are laser weapons that can do that already. You can launch a missile from the Earth's surface, from a ship or a land-based silo, and target assets that are essentially defenseless. I mean, a satellite is a very fragile piece of, you know, man-made machinery.
It can't really protect itself.
At this point, you can maneuver them out of the way. You can harden them, but many of the things that make them most effective at their jobs, at their missions, mean that they can't be protected physically in the way that you would want.
And Peter Singer, when this attack takes place on the American satellite infrastructure, in the book, how devastatingly successful are the Chinese? And by devastatingly, I mean, what is the impact on the U.S. military?
Well, he who controls the heavens controls what happens back on Earth. And so essentially satellite communications, you know, back in World War II, they were first conceived by a scientist at the time, Arthur C. Clarke, who becomes more famous as a science fiction writer. And since then, you know, we have literally thousands of satellites up there, and they're the nervous system for not just the military, but also the civilian world. You know, we both depend on things for communications, but also GPS, surveillance, whether it's military surveillance to Google Earth-style surveillance. And so whoever is able to take it out or deny it to the other side will be at a huge advantage and will throw the other side back to, you know, a pre-digital age style. They'll be back to fighting like it's World War II, where they can't even find the adversary. And so it's immense. It's immensely important. And it's why we're seeing, you know, this arms race there, where China's tested anti-satellite weaponry that ranges from ballistic missiles to Russia has reputedly launched a killer satellite program to the U.S. In turn, we just announced $5 billion in spending on space warfare capabilities. And I wanted to hit that earlier question that you had about, lasers. Lasers were, or directed energy as they're scientifically known, they were once, totally science fiction, the kind of Star Wars in the movies. And then it was science fiction in terms of when Reagan was talking about it. Oh, Star Wars back in the 1980s, you will be able to use. Well, now lasers are real and they're being deployed into war. The U.S. Navy, for example, has a ship out in the Persian Gulf that's equipped with a laser weapon. To the laser in the book that's used in the Chinese space station is actually a derivative of one that the U.S. Air Force has tested called a COIL system. And actually, just last week, China showed off at an arms trade show that they were working on a variety of laser weapons. So, essentially, again, lasers seem like sci-fi, pew, pew, but it is going to be part of the future of war. And that's amazing when you pull back and think about it, because it's a weapon that we've literally never seen before that you won't be able to see as it's firing.
And I will answer the question I put to you. In the book, the U.S. military is absolutely crippled. I mean, as you say, once China controls the skies, it's...
And it's also the idea of not just taking out our space capabilities, but also our dependence on the internet. And that's where you bring in cyber warfare. And essentially, what we're looking at in the book is, it's a fictional scenario, but you're taking the two sides' battle plans and interacting them. And that could be very scary for the U.S.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking with P.W. Singer and August Cole about their fictionalized account that imagines what World War III would look like and asks some troubling questions about preparedness. So we're talking with P.W. Singer. He's a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation, and with August Cole, who's a senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council, and their new book is called Ghost Fleet, A Novel of the Next World War. An interesting thing that happens in the book, in this devastating opening scene in which China gets control of the skies, and it's literally to the point where pilots' GPS is sending them in the wrong direction. They're fighting very terrifyingly. They're fighting drone aircraft, small aircraft that are devastating and therefore fearless. There's no such thing really as a kamikaze attack by a drone aircraft because there's no life to be lost. And so the Chinese attack and deploys a lot of drones, particularly against, appropriately enough, I suppose, from a historical point of view, Pearl Harbor and Hawaii. And China wins. China wins the battle and takes over Hawaii and occupies it. And a lot of the book covers, August Cole, the occupation and a kind of resistance that takes place in Hawaii that's very low tech, I would say.
That's right. The focus of the U.S. military for since 9/11 really has been on waging counterinsurgency and counterterrorism operations, finding individuals or small groups of people. And so the military has oriented itself accordingly. Yet in a big power conflict like we're talking about here, where U.S. territory is lost, we imagined what Americans might be like as insurgents themselves. Mm-hmm. What did we learn from the bad guys? How far are we willing to go with many of the tactics that we've seen used against us, from roadside bombs to small unit raids to living and using the local population for both shelter but also intelligence, and the bind that puts the Chinese and Russian forces that are there in. I mean, one of the ways we explore that is trying to see it through the eyes of the occupier. And a character we have particularly is sort of giving advice that is more seasoned and experienced versus a more kind of blunt approach, very much reflecting the real counterinsurgency debates out there. For our insurgents themselves, we called on actual former service members for that research and tried to create a realistic sort of unit in terms of both how it would operate, but in terms of its objectives and the patterns of its and tactics and that sort of thing.
Well, in terms of tactics, P.W. Singer, I found it very interesting that some of the resistance fighters, they call themselves the Mujahideen or the Muj, which is the name that is applied to Afghan fighters. And they use a tactic at one point that is so criticized nowadays by us when our enemies do it. And that's this, that they have a weapons cache in Hawaii and they hide it at a school. They're hiding it from the Chinese occupiers and from the Russian occupiers by putting all of these weapons in a school. And what happens is that it's discovered and the school is basically destroyed with a lot of children killed by the Chinese, who consider this a barbaric act on the part of the Americans to hide these weapons among children. Very, very interested in why you made that choice.
It creates a powerful scene, an emotional scene, and as it plays out, the two of the characters in that insurgent group, both U.S. veterans, essentially argue about it because one, you know, takes, just as you put it, you know, how could, why are we doing this? How could this have happened? And the other one takes a very you know, bloody-minded, want-to-win-the-war-first approach, which is, this is exactly why we put the weapons here, not just to hide them, but if things went bad, it would go bad in a way that would harm the other side even more in their war of ideas. And so it's reflecting the kind of debates that are happening on both sides in war today. So we're using this future war as a way of mirroring things that are playing out today. And again, it's interesting because it's not just a likely tactic that would be utilized from these discussions with American veterans on what they've learned from the other side. They're not saying that they like it. They're saying these are things that have worked, that if we were in a hard place, we might turn to. It also echoes things that have happened in history. You know, for example, if you go back to the Revolutionary War, many of the complaints that the British Redcoats were making about how the American rebels weren't fighting by the rules, almost word for word what some of our forces say today in places like Afghanistan. And then finally, it echoes some of the science fiction that we love. So, for example, this storyline is influenced as much by interviews with special forces operators as one of the best seasons of Battlestar Galactica, the reboot. And that's again, the influence of this book is it's a mashup of the things that surround us, whether it be real world history to the science fiction that August and I either love from today or the books that we loved reading earlier, like the Tom Clancy's of the world. It brings all these different things together. There's even a John Steinbeck story. There's another character in The Insurgency that's essentially, it's hard to figure out whether she's an insurgent or whether she's a murderer, an assassin kind of operating on her own. Mm-hmm. And this character, you know, again, we pulled in research on everything from assassins to serial killers to there's a John Steinbeck story that from World War II that's a parallel to Dexter, the Showtime series about the serial killer that, you know, puts you in this weird conflicted feeling of should you be cheering for the serial killer if they're taking out bad guys?
One of the reasons that insurgency storyline was so important was that we wanted to take as many assumptions about the American way of war and turn them on their heads, from the fact that we assume that many of our frontline aircraft will fly as we want them to on the day of a major fight, to the kind of tactics that we would use if our backs were really up against the wall. You know, fiction allows you to do that in a fairly safe way, in a way that isn't, you know, beholden to bureaucracy, isn't beholden to officialdom. And so that's one of the things that has made the book, I think, helpful to readers trying to think about this in a realistic context in the future. As writers, it was really hard to do because we pushed a lot of ethical boundaries with our characters, and that is not always the most comfortable thing, but we felt it was important.
And yeah, I would add in one other thing is that this idea of your back's against the wall and how it changes your perspective, it applies in both the low-tech realm. So these insurgents are using weapons very effectively that are pulled from, you know, stores and, you know, jury-rigged systems, just like what's happened in war. You know, IEDs that have been so dangerous for U.S. forces, I is for improvised. But it's also playing out in the high-tech side. and connects to debates like, for example, right now over killer robotics and autonomy, where we've seen a number of leaders, over 2,000 tech leaders and scientists recently came together to say, you know, we shouldn't be using autonomous weapons. But of course, our attitudes towards them might be different depending on what kind of war we're fighting and how we're doing in that war. And a great historic illustration of this is the submarine, where in World War I, the U.S. considered it horrifying to use a submarine against civilian shipping. And then Pearl Harbor happens, and it took us 5 hours after Pearl Harbor attacks in 1941 to change our mind about using submarines in an unrestricted warfare. So again, ethics sometimes in war, it's unfortunate to say, is context-driven. And that gives you, you know, really cool things to play with in a novel, because they're powerful emotions that are drawn from it.
It's just fascinating to see the Americans using IEDs and blowing up convoys and murdering somewhat, you know, regular Chinese GIs, you know, slitting their throats in sort of sex traps in order to send a message, and things that we always ascribe to the bad guys. I want to bring in Jack from Nashville, Tennessee, to join the conversation. Jack, welcome to On Point.
Yes. Hi, John.
Hi.
My question really is, you know, a lot of what you talked about are fairly publicly known technologies and approaches and issues, but I think everybody who pays any attention to the field, and I'm ex-military, is aware that there's a lot of black budget activity that goes on in terms of technological research, development, that it would be highly unlikely that anybody in the public sphere would know about, and people on the inside would be very unlikely to talk about if they did. So I'm just curious how you baked into your story those kinds of possibilities which are unlikely to be known.
Well, we wanted to work with technologies to start with that were real. Then that means knowable, so that there's no classified information in this book, first off, which is an important thing to say. That's in part why those endnotes at the back of the book are insignificant, because you can start to track programs by their funding streams and that sort of thing, you know, from kind of recent announcements, whether it's a contract with DARPA. But many of the technologies, though, that we do use and do develop would have roots, if you will, both operationally in terms of concept in the classified world, such as unmanned systems and the naval context. Or that is, for example, something that you see a overt approach to the programs, but certainly there are plenty of facets to those that are not visible for the public. And that's something I think that is important to understand too, that we're in an era of technology, though, where a lot of the innovation, a lot of the most relevant technologies are actually coming from outside the military. And so that to assume that our own government has a monopoly on the best ideas because we can hide them, a certain initiative or a certain program under a classified budget, I think is a really dangerous assumption. And that's something I think they're struggling with at the Defense Department right now with the third offset strategy, which is very much a program that is designed to maintain our technological edge.
You go ahead, Peter. Go ahead.
I would add in that I think sometimes we overstate what can stay classified. And it's not just today. You know, one of the inspirations for us in writing this book was Tom Clancy's Red Storm Rising. And in that book, which was about a fictional World War III against the Soviets in the 1980s, he writes about the appearance of this new kind of plane that's stealthy. He's writing about it in the book 2 years before the Air Force admitted that we had it. So, you know, there's been this history of things being talked about in fiction before they become real. And we play with that, as August mentioned, of the way you go after it is find it by, for example, contract announcements or basic research that then goes dark later on, so you can find inklings of it. And it's not just about the U.S. side, but it's also, for example, about the Chinese side, where it's a much more closed system, but there's still things that you can pull out from it. So, for example, you're able to tease out information about the next generation of Chinese drones, or even what will equip their aircraft carriers by things that have either been deliberately leaked by them as a way of kind of showing off, or things that have accidentally come out, like, for example, people taking a selfie in a harbor and the aircraft carriers under construction behind them. And then you can marry that up with Google Earth to figure out the size of the aircraft carrier and things like that. So there's a lot of ways that you can pull things that later on will go, oh, of course that was happening.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to point out when we're talking about the endnotes, you know, endnotes are like footnotes, but they all go at the end of the book, and that's why they're called endnotes. And you have a few hundred of these notes that tie specific references to weapons and to places and to ships to real things that are already present today. And here's an example. You make reference to a ship, the USS Gabrielle Giffords, a ship that obviously in the future is named in honor of the wounded congresswoman. However, you've pointed out that you cite in the endnotes that on April 16th, 2014, plans were made announcing the designation of a ship called the USS Gabrielle Giffords. There is going to be a ship like that in the future. We know that now. So that's a very good example of the sort of how you've rooted everything in the future in a present reality.
One of the really important things when you're writing fiction and probably science fiction even more so is finding that sweet spot for the right amount of information to give your reader. If you give them too much, they can get too anchored in reality in a negative sense. If you don't give them enough, your story's not credible. And that's one of the tensions, I think, in this sort of military fiction too, where you can write a book, if you're not careful, that is too much like a weapons research report, mm-hmm. That is devoid of character, devoid of narrative. But if you're able to put it all in context and at the same time anchoring it in the things that we are familiar with or know a little bit, then you can take the reader, really going back to that show versus tell adage in journalism, you can take them with you into this future world and show them what is coming.
Another thing you've done is you made some assumptions about what's happening politically. And we haven't mentioned this, but the China that attacks the United States is not communist China, because the communists have been overthrown more or less by a sort of corporate capitalist class, a very, very wealthy billionaires in league with forward-looking military leaders have overthrown the Communist Party. So that's different. Also, the kinds of conflicts that take place. There's been a series of conflicts before the novel begins. They're all basically financial crises. Financial disruptions are the things that are destabilizing the world in this time, 20 to 30 years down the road. But a thing I found very, very interesting is that part of the solution for the Americans is to take over Walmart. What's the thinking there?
Walmart has one of the largest, if not the largest, infrastructure networks in the country. And if you think about the challenges that the U.S. government would face in a wartime economy of literally moving material from A to B, from being able to harness the kind of logistical resources that you would ascribe to the Army Corps of Engineers in the past, or even the actual other parts of the military. What you have in the private sector now is something that's far greater and more efficient and more nimble. And then there's also – you can overlay with that additive manufacturing as well, which is something we play with in the book as being revolutionary in the defense context. But the important thing about this facet to the story is we get into the very question of what allegiance does a company owe the country where it's headquartered? Is it its allegiance to the shareholders? You know, these are very real questions today in a non-military context. But in wartime, this is going to matter even more.
And go ahead, Peter.
And what that storyline is playing with is how if there was a major war, which again is not something that's inevitable, but it is something that's, you know, back on the radar screen of risk today, that if it was a major war, it would involve a broader part of the American populace and the American economy. But the last time that happened was in the 1940s and, you know, places like Detroit were the centerpiece of the American economy. Well, now it's places like a Silicon Valley or a Bentonville, Arkansas. And, you know, as August was hitting at, you get these interesting questions of everything from what would venture capitalists in Silicon Valley do to a multinational corporation? Where does its loyalties lie? Is it with the founder? Is it with the headquarters? Is it where the business is? Is it where the owners are? And these are fun from a story standpoint. There's a really neat scene of a shareholder meeting argument over it. But it's also, again, reflecting real kind of debates that are happening now. For example, after the Snowden affair, many of these companies we're trying to wrestle with. Are we an American company? Are we a multinational mm-hmm. company? How do we navigate that?
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we are talking about a fictionalized account of World War III fought in cyberspace and outer space. So we are talking with P.W. Singer. He's a strategist and senior fellow at the New America Foundation, and with August Cole, who's a senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council. So last month, two hackers took control of a 2014 Jeep Cherokee, and CNN reported on the incident.
Two professional hackers, armed with only laptops and an internet connection, remotely broke into the internal system of this 2014 Jeep Cherokee. They took control of the Jeep's locks, the steering, the speedometer, even disabled the brakes.
And this was while the car was moving. And we're joined now by the man who was behind the wheel when this happened to him, Andy Greenberg. He's a senior writer at Wired magazine and author of the July 21st article, Hackers Remotely Kill a Jeep on the Highway with Me in It, and the July 29th article, Hackers Can Disable a Sniper Rifle or Change Its Target. You can link to his articles on our website, onpointradio.org. Andy Greenberg, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. And so what's the story of you in this Jeep and it being taken over by guys far away with a laptop?
Yeah, so I've known these two hackers, Charlie Miller and Chris Valasek, for years. And 3 years ago, they began working on this problem of whether a car could be hacked, not only with physical access to it, but wirelessly over the internet. And just this summer, they told me, or I learned actually through the abstract of a talk that they're giving at the Black Hat Hacker Conference later this month, in a few days actually, that they had finally achieved this and that they had wireless access to some vehicle, although they didn't say which one. So I convinced them to let me come down to St. Louis, and they put me behind the wheel of, it turned out, a 2014 Jeep Cherokee, told me to drive it onto the highway. They didn't tell me what they were going to do, but they told me they were going to demonstrate some sort of hacking technique. And they proceeded, as you said, to monkey with the radio, the vents. They turned on the windshield wipers. They put a picture of themselves on the dashboard screen. I thought all that was, pretty entertaining. And then suddenly they cut the transmission to the vehicle altogether while I was driving on the highway. And there was no shoulder. There was nowhere for me to escape to. I was basically in a paralyzed vehicle on the highway. And I felt, I think for the first time, hopefully, I don't know if this has ever happened to anyone else, but I don't think it has, the real danger of what it's like to have hackers remotely disable a vehicle that you're driving.
Did they know where you were when you were disabled?
Well, they could track my GPS, but they didn't know that at that point on the highway that there would be no shoulder. So they thought that I would just be able to kind of roll off the highway. I think it was a far more real danger than was intended with this simulation.
And could they have done this if you had not cooperated with them? In other words, if you hadn't given them permission in some way, would they still, I'm assuming it would be against the law, but technically could they have done it anyway?
Well, the one thing that they needed to know was the Jeep's IP address, and they knew that because it was their Jeep, in fact. But if they hadn't known that IP address, they could still scan and find any Jeep Cherokee's IP address or any of hundreds of thousands of other Chrysler vehicles. They have this technique of using a Sprint phone to scan the network to which these Chrysler vehicles' computer, called the Uconnect, connects. So all of those in-dashboard computers, the Uconnects, have a Sprint connection. They can use a Sprint phone to find at random, basically, any vulnerable computer inside of one of these cars and to start monkeying with it.
And what about hacking a rifle?
Well, that was a different story. Because this is the kind of season of hacker conferences, Black Hat and DEF CON, all of the hackers in this research community are starting to surface their most interesting stuff. And Charlie and Chris gave me a preview of their car hacking thing. A pair of other hackers, Michael Auger and Runa Sandvik, showed me an entirely different demonstration in which they hacked a sniper rifle. This was actually a tracking point, $13,000 self-aiming sniper rifle. It has a Linux computer in its scope that makes it possible for even an entirely inexperienced shooter to hit a target from as much as a mile away. It's a really remarkable piece of equipment. But it also has a Wi-Fi connection, and the makers of this really amazing rifle didn't secure that connection properly. Runa and Michael, her husband, they're actually married, were able to hack into it through anywhere from within Wi-Fi range, take control of the computer, disable the rifle if they wanted to permanently, even if they chose, or even choose the target. They could re-target the sniper rifle so that the shooter would believe that they were hitting one target when, in fact, the hackers were choosing a different target altogether.
Well, Andy, thanks so much for joining us. You've given us a lot to think about here, giving us a dose of the reality that we're in now. It's sure. A little bit scary, but thanks very much. And again, excerpts from your pieces are on our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks a lot, Andy.
Thank you.
So, Peter Singer, is that just the tiny, tiny tip of the iceberg, what Andy was just talking about? Is, you know, given that that's doable today, if that were sort of technique were applied to an army, what would happen to that army? Would the tanks be crashing into each other?
It's a tiny piece of an exponentially growing iceberg is the way to think about it. Yes, you know, we obviously have huge amounts of cybersecurity issues, both on the civilian side, but also on the governmental and military side. And, you know, an illustration of this would be that last year, the U.S. top weapon tester looked at every single major U.S. weapons program and found, in their words, significant vulnerabilities in them. That's the things we found, let alone the ones that later surface, like what happened at the OPM breach, where we've already lost 20 information on 21 million Americans to hackers linked back to China. So you have those vulnerabilities that are there. The second thing that's risky is that there's a variety of actions and programs that we've shown can work that could be used back against us. So one example would be some of the things revealed in the Snowden files that the NSA has done to others, like Stuxnet, or able to carry out attacks over air gaps. A lot of these interesting things, what we explore in the book, is how other parts of the U.S. government are equally vulnerable to them. So, you know, what we've done to others can be done back at us. And there's a scene in the book where a U.S. intelligence headquarters building is hacked through this. I actually had the fun, weird experience of standing in that building and explaining that my upcoming novel was going to reveal how this building could be hacked. But then the third thing that's out there that's maybe the toughest is not just the software, but the hardware. The chips themselves are made elsewhere, designed elsewhere, not just in, you know, our cars or whatnot, but even in our most sophisticated weapon system, the Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35, for example. Over 70% of the microchips in it are made in places like China and Taiwan, which are the adversaries they might go after. And so the point is that you could have the vulnerabilities literally baked into the weapon.
Another kind of vulnerability that you write about a lot is a sort of psychological vulnerability that we now in the United States feel, not necessarily with full justification, but we feel that we sit at the top of the technological mountain. You know, there are other countries that are more advanced in terms of some networking and smartphones, that sort of thing, where we're actually catching up. But I think there's a general feeling that we're the king of this castle. And in the book, that advantage is wiped out by this early attack, and when the system is so badly compromised. And August Cole, you're going to read a section where a Chinese leader reflects on what this has all done to the American psyche.
Sure. This is a section that involves one of our characters, Admiral Wang, who is a naval officer. "Please put on your glasses," said Admiral Wang. He donned a matte black carbon and titanium mesh pair of Prada Viz glasses, a Shanghai-only limited edition model that his mistress had bought for him soon after the invasion of Hawaii. They were too flashy for his taste, but he knew they would go over well with this crowd. The Viz feed took them through the flag – that's an American flag – and into a sweeping tour of images collected from both intelligence sources and open-source feed. A line of F-35 fighter jets sat abandoned at Kadena Airfield, the base now back under Japanese control as part of the neutrality deal. Then, a line of American families waiting at a food relief center in Indianapolis, all of them eyeing the neon-orange boxes on the other side of a taped blue line. The next image was the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives, where lawmakers from the 2nd Congressional District of West Virginia and the 6th Congressional District of Washington State flailed at each other with liver-spotted fists. That was followed by a bed of wilting roses laid around the hooves of the famous bull sculpture on Wall Street, a reminder of the rash of trader suicides that had followed the stock market's collapse. These images show the new reality the Americans are learning to live with. In time, they will see the advantage of their fate, said Admiral Wang.
Well, that to me was the most powerful paragraph in the thing that says that at least at that point in the book, the indications are that we were so unready for this and so used to being dominant
technologically that we've just had the wind knocked out of us?
There's a value in thinking the unthinkable, and this is something that we don't do enough. A story like this puts us on the back foot from the beginning, as we've talked about, and that's a really important exercise in the real world. You know, you can take this book if you're in Washington and give it to your boss if they're a general or an admiral, and they can read it over the weekend and come back and think a little bit differently about their world on Monday. And when we think about China, we tend to think about it in a fairly kind of linear sense. You know, the Communist Party will either be here in perpetuity, or it'll be here, or rather the country will shift into a democratic sort of movement. And we kind of explore a wholly different reality, an America that finds its confidence in its own abilities misplaced. Mm-hmm. And we want to, you know, raise awareness around that, as well as, you know, writing a book that is enjoyable and entertaining because, you know, we are readers first, Pete and I, but also really care deeply about these issues.
Let's bring in Sandy from Bourne, Massachusetts. Sandy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hi.
My concern about the book, which I just finished, was the collapse of NATO, where our only ally ended up being Poland and, of course, Great Britain. But did the authors do research to determine that this, in fact, is a possibility?
Peter, what about that?
It reflects, again, not just a future world, but things that are happening right now. So, for example, while we mentioned that NATO is at its highest levels of alert since the Cold War, and you've had the Russian seizure of parts of Ukraine and bombers visiting NATO's borders, if you look at actual European defense spending since that started, it's gone down. Not up. It's gone down to you don't have to wait for a future world where, you have a war that's happened and a war that's not gone well for the U.S. at this point, a war that's in the Pacific. Just ask this today. If something played out in the South China Sea today, do you think Belgium would show up? Do you think Luxembourg's going to declare war on China? These are things. So again, what we're playing with, and it echoes back to what August was saying earlier about these issues, is that we have to understand, and there's a character who says this, that just because the world is a certain way today doesn't mean it's going to be that way tomorrow. But even more so, the way we think about the world today may not reflect current reality. And so you don't have to wait for the fictional scenario of a World War III to say, hold it, maybe the alliance with NATO isn't the same that it was 30, 40 years ago, or the American technology edge that we think we have. It doesn't just take a war for it not to be there. That technology edge, that inheritance that we have from our grandfathers, that's not there right now.
Since it is fiction, it's not a prediction. It doesn't have to go that way. But does your book point the way to preventing that sort of devastating outcome for the United States, August?
I think one of the takeaways from the book is that we cannot take our position in the world for granted, and that we need to look at China with a very careful eye, but also not put them into a position where they feel they only have military action as the sure path to fulfilling their sense of national destiny. There's this larger question of destiny in the book that we explore for both our characters, but also these two countries in the Pacific. You know, China looks back on its history as far greater than just going back to 1949, whereas we tend to look at it on a much shorter time cycle since the Communist Party came into power. And with their economy growing, with that economic growth funding a military that is developing in terms of size, but also capability and competency, that is going to change fundamentally how they view their relationship with the world. You know, in their most recent national military strategy, which is an important document to read, it talks very clearly about their position in the world being guaranteed by military strength. And particular attention is being paid to space and cyberspace as well.
You have a lot of where you move forward the technology that interacts with the human body, not just these visors that people see the future through, but people have chips embedded in them. And very noticeably, people seem to be addicted to stimulants. And without a taboo about it, at least among the younger people, the attitude is, I need to get an important job done. I'm going to take this dose to get it done, and then I'll be finished with it. What's your thinking there?
Well, we see this happening already today, whether it's the off-label use of a variety of drugs that even starts for a lot of people in high school and into college to ensure academic performance, to the performance-enhancing substances that athletes are taking again.
But there's a taboo about it today. In the future, there doesn't seem to be.
I would say there's a nominal taboo today that is being broken with such regularity that you see, in fact, the way people really think about the advantage these things confer. We make it official, if you will, in the militaries for both the U.S. and China that, you know, you can chew a stimulant gum to remain on edge, or the corpsman on your ship may give you a suite of pills to pick from, because the advances that we're seeing in technology and computing power are potentially outstripping our human ability to keep up with it. Mm. And this is one of the ways I think we will start to compensate more.
All right. The future looking not so bright at the moment, but there is hope. Hope does shine through the book. I want to point that out. I want to thank the two gentlemen who wrote this book for joining me. August Cole, thanks for joining us here in Boston. And Peter Singer, thanks for coming in from Washington.
Thank you.
Book is called Ghost Fleet, A Novel of the Next World War. And you continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, comedic actor Jason Segel gets serious and takes on author David Foster Wallace in the new film, The End of the Tour. He'll be with us. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.